Coming up next is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, the challenges of communicating with Alzheimer's patients.
If you think about communicating on an everyday basis, a lot of times we have miscommunications, even with individuals who don't have the disease. So when you add the extra component, it really can be very challenging and trying in certain situations.
Plus, the relationship between climate change and new strains of infectious diseases.
Warmer air temperatures and more rainfall has increased the risk of a disease in these areas.
And is sleeplessness in children normal or perhaps a true disorder?
This simple developmental problem will end up to a disorder where the adolescents sleep very late and they have to wake up very early to go to school. Then we end up with a sleepy teenager.
Our checkup from the neck up and a selection from our Healing Muse, and they're all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, how global warming and climate change is driving the emergence of new and more virulent infectious diseases. Plus, we'll find out if your child has trouble sleeping, is it normal or a true disorder? But first, what are the most effective ways to communicate with patients with Alzheimer's disease? Alzheimer's disease and other dementias gradually interfere with a person's ability to communicate, such that communicating with a person with Alzheimer's disease requires patience, understanding, and good listening skills. We'll hear with more on how to maintain and enhance communication with these patients is Katrina Skevel. She's the Chief Program Officer for the Alzheimer's Association of Central New York. Welcome, Katrina. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So communication really changes with individuals with Alzheimer's or any dementia, really. Tell us how.
Yeah, changes can affect someone with the Alzheimer's disease or another dementia. Really, it depends on the individual. The disease typically starts in the hippocampus, which is related to short-term memory. But from there, the disease can really affect any and all parts of the brain, including someone's ability to communicate. So as the disease continues to progress, someone may experience various changes in their communication abilities.
Tell me some of the characteristics that you might see in terms of beginning to recognize that something is amiss.
Sure. One of the most common changes that we do see is difficulty finding the right words. So someone may have a word that's kind of on the tip of their tongue, but they can't come up with it, and it's kind of just hanging in front of them, and they can't seem to find that word. Another example might be someone actually making up words. So for example, instead of calling a watch, they may actually call it a hand clock and get a little, describe the object rather than actually come up with the word. Someone else may have easily lose their train of thought. They may get distracted more in having conversation. They may also be much more repetitious. And slowly, as the disease continues to progress, they may actually speak less often. A lot of people actually do identify these changes in themselves and therefore will remove themselves from these situations and conversing a lot with individuals.
So to be able to as this progresses, obviously it has to have an interfere not just with communication, but with relationship in a way. And it's sometimes probably hard to know what the person means, or it seems like it's probably very trying for the individual who's trying to communicate with the person as well in knowing exactly what all this means. What is the person really meaning to say? Mm-hmm. What are they really? Is there an emotional component underlying it? What would you suggest that people who are trying to communicate regularly with people with Alzheimer's or other dementias do? Let's kind of go through what are the critical things. Obviously I mentioned in the introduction that patience is very important here. Tell us more about that.
Well, you alluded to it that communication really changes for both the person with the disease as well as their caregivers and their friends and family members. If you think about communicating on an everyday basis, a lot of times we have miscommunications, even with individuals who don't have the disease. So when you add the extra component, it really can be very challenging and trying in certain situations. So, you know, I think first of all, the number one thing I first say is not to make any assumptions. Just because someone has Alzheimer's disease doesn't mean they're going to have the level of difficulty that you may expect. Someone actually may still be able to articulate their words very well, even though they're having some challenges in other areas related to memory and so forth. So if someone is having challenges communicating their words and actually articulating their words, that also doesn't mean that they're going to have difficulty understanding you. So it kind of can be, you know, on either side. They may have difficulty with comprehension or they may have difficulty with the articulation. But again, I always say don't actually make assumptions related to that. And then certainly there's a number of different basic strategies that we can go over right now. You know, I think just we'll kind of start from early, middle to late stage because that's generally how we talk about the progression of the disease. So in the early stages, I already mentioned don't make any assumptions. Certainly don't exclude an individual from conversations. You still want to encourage them to communicate and speak directly to the person. Again, even if they're having some difficulties, we want to make sure we uphold that integrity of that conversation and talk directly to them. Always give the person time to respond. It may take them a little bit longer to process the information. So it's good to state your question or your statement and then let that sink in for the person before you actually expect a response back.
So patience sounds to me to be a major factor here that you really, I think that maybe one's own anxiety in communicating with someone with a problem might make you move quickly to either fill in a word or answer for them or maybe not even communicate with them fully. But the idea here is if you can give them space and time and you are patient in your interaction, that it gives the person the respect and the opportunity to perhaps do things at the best of to their fullest ability.
Absolutely. And again, if you allow them that time, then that's really setting them up for success. With a lot of these tips, it actually probably will seem like a lot of common sense when we say, well, give them some more time. You know, breaking your conversation down into smaller steps. So don't ask them five questions at once. Ask them one question at a time so that they can comprehend the question, think of a response, and then respond back.
It also strikes me that there are some tendencies that we might have, again, I think probably as a result of our own anxiety in talking to someone who is somewhat communicatively impaired, or even this idea of the anxiety that stems from seeing a person who was able to have the full use of their faculties now don't, that I think people will do things like perhaps correct or criticize or argue about a point. And obviously those are not things you want to be doing.
Correct. And actually, you know, as the disease begins to progress into the middle stages where someone may be having more difficulties with communication, that's a really, really big point. We encourage people not to correct the individual, not to argue with the individual. And that's because whatever the person is experiencing in their reality truly is their reality. You mentioned respect earlier. You know, if we are correcting that person, and that's constantly just reminding them, oh, you're wrong or you said it inaccurately. And really, it doesn't usually matter if they're recounting a series of events in the exact appropriate order. You know, we used the example one time at one of our education programs that, you know, if someone says, oh, I had 25 kids, and their daughter's looking at the woman saying, you didn't have 25 kids, there was only five of us. Well, does it really matter to correct her in saying, no, you only had five? No, it's whatever she is remembering. You know, maybe the five kids felt like 25 kids, right? Or maybe she's actually recalling all of her grandkids and her great grandkids too. So again, that's just kind of a simple example. We don't need to correct that all of the time.
And I think, but what I was trying to get at is I think, and from my own experience as well, that it kind of sometimes stems from an anxiety that you have in dealing with a person because it's hard to see them failing where they were once capable. And now they're showing that they're less capable. And so I think that anxiety maybe pushes you to do things that what you're really counseling is very important not to do.
Absolutely.
How about things like encouraging unspoken communication? In other words, just basically, if you don't understand what somebody is being said, maybe ask them to point or to gesture. Mm-hmm. If that's a successful way of getting there. Is that a reasonable thing to do?
Yes. Nonverbal communication is extremely important, especially as someone is having more difficulty with the verbal side of communication. So pointing, gesturing can be very, very beneficial, not only for you to understand as a caregiver, but also for the person with the disease to understand what you're talking about.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with Katrina Skevel from the Central New York Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, and we're talking about how to maintain effective communication with individuals with Alzheimer's. So ongoing communication is really, really crucial. So as you've begun to illuminate these for us, tell us a little bit more specifically some techniques. I mean, is it important, for example, to identify yourself when you're talking to someone? Give us a kind of a little to-do list or something. Help us with that.
Well, identifying yourself is always a great place to start, especially even if you're just coming into the room. If the person is having some difficulties recognizing you, just gently remind them who you are. It's also important to approach the person from the front. You may startle them if you're approaching them from the back. They may also not see you when you're starting to talk to them. So make sure they're looking at you before you begin having that conversation. It can also be helpful to get down to eye level with them. Again, make sure that they're engaged with you, and also make sure that there's limited distractions going on around you. If the TV is on, it can be helpful to turn it off, turn the radio off, limit any other sort of distractions, especially if you're looking for that full, meaningful engagement of conversation.
How about the length of your sentences? You mentioned before you don't want to ask five questions, but how about even if you're making a statement?
It's always best to kind of make things a little bit shorter. Make sure that you do articulate your words as well. In some cases, it can be helpful to turn questions into statements. So rather than say, do you want to go outside for a walk? Say, let's go outside for a walk. And kind of turn it into, again, that statement. You know, if you do ask a question, it can be helpful to ask in a yes or no fashion. So rather than, what do you want to drink today? Well, there's a lot of options someone could come up with. So instead say...
Or not be able to come up with.
Exactly. So instead say, would you like some coffee? And kind of a help there. It can also be helpful to not utilize pronouns. So rather than say, put that over there... Say, put the cup on the table. The person may have difficulty interpreting what pronouns are actually being used for.
It's interesting because in some ways, my background is a speech and language pathologist, and I worked with children developing language. And many of the things that you're saying, well, they do follow. But in the case of trying to get a child to develop more options for language, you might actually use more, you illuminate more and you actually use lengthier things than just simplifying. You would rather try to amplify rather than just simplify. And here what you're doing is drilling down to the simplest, most concrete ways of communicating that are possible. So even things like turning a negative, potential negative statement into a positive statement, like saying, instead of saying, don't go there, you might say, let's go here.
Yes.
So there's a lot of similarities there too.
Absolutely.
How about writing things down? Does that help for people who are having communication problems verbally?
Yeah, writing things down, also using pictures. So labeling, you know, various parts of the house or the home, you know, for example, putting picture of a glass on the cupboard that has all of the glasses in it for drinking water and so forth. That can be really helpful. Part of communication, too, is that someone may have difficulty reading and writing. So, again, we can't assume what the person is having struggles with. So try every different avenue. Try all of these things and see what works best for your loved one.
And it sounds to me like one of the things you're saying all along is this notion of respect and being aware of the tone of your communication. It should be calm, patient, reassuring, and not judgmental or frustrated, if possible, in terms of that whole interaction. Well, what would you recommend? Because since obviously all these changes in a person require a great deal of care and coordination for a family, what's your overall recommendation in a little bit of time we have left?
Sure. You know, overall, I think you highlighted patience. You know, really people have to begin to modify their expectations. And, you know, people without the disease are really the ones who have to change their techniques and their style. You know, this disease changes a person's abilities. So we have to kind of work with it and be adaptive to what's going on to meet the needs of everyone.
And what are the kinds of resources for families today?
You know, I'm so glad you asked that because, you know, being from the Alzheimer's Association, there is a number of resources that we can help families with in this situation. And whether it be communications or maybe they're having difficulties with various behaviors or wandering, I'd really encourage people to reach out to their local Alzheimer's Association chapter. We have a number of education programs that we offer. We actually have one just on communication alone, as well as support groups. And most importantly, we do have a 24-hour helpline number so that if people have these questions or if they're feeling very frustrated because of these challenges, they can reach out to us at any time at that number.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, Katrina. This is very, very helpful information. My guest has been Katrina Skevel. She's the Chief Program Officer for the Alzheimer's Association of Central New York. Next up, how is global warming bringing on more infectious diseases? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Dengue fever. Well, it's one of the fastest spreading tropical diseases, and it's now in the continental U.S., and it does pose a real threat to our country. We'll hear with more on this disease and some of her research findings that may help us in the battle with it is Dr. Anna Stewart Ibarra from the Center for Global Health and Translational Science at Upstate Medical University. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Linda.
So let's begin by helping us understand what we mean by dengue fever. What is dengue?
So dengue fever is a disease. A febrile disease causes fever, bone, joint aches, rash. And it's a disease that's caused by a virus that's transmitted by a certain species of mosquitoes called the Aedes aegypti mosquito principally. There's another species also, Aedes albopictus. And so those mosquitoes transmit the disease from one person to another, typically within the tropics and subtropics. And so
it's never, it's not human to human transmission.
Correct. Right.
So it's literally much like malaria.
Malaria or other kinds of like tick-borne or West Nile. You know, you have to have that intermediate mosquito to be able to get the disease.
And basically, how does it manifest itself? You said fever, chills. Mm-hmm. Wasn't it once called bone break disease or something of that nature? What does that mean?
Yeah, so dengue is also called breakbone fever some parts.
Yeah,
so it causes severe fever and joint aches. It depends on the person, too, because there's a spectrum of disease, right? So you could have people who have no symptoms, to very mild symptoms, through more severe, even hemorrhaging, shock, and death. And so that's one of the things we want to understand sort of more from the immunology side is what are the triggers.
So what is the morbidity and mortality? In other words, what happens to people generally? Because I know there is no cure, per se, right now. So what happens when you get dengue?
Right. So that's something important to mention. Today, there doesn't exist any kind of specific cure or vaccine for the disease. And so we have to have really good clinical management of patients who become ill with dengue.
So it's supportive therapies, mostly like
hydration,
fluids.
Exactly. Fluids, taking, you know, just medicine to reduce the fever. Yeah, but and close monitoring, looking to make sure there's no hemorrhaging or bleeding if you have people going into more severe disease, which is, so your question was going to what is the spectrum and how often do you see severe disease, or most people actually probably never show symptoms. So most people could be infected and be totally, what we call asymptomatic, right? A certain smaller proportion of people may have mild febrile, mild fever, you know, maybe a day or two home from work, that sort of thing. Kind of like a flu or a bad cold. And then a much smaller proportion would actually progress to a more severe disease that would require hospitalization. And generally, the disease can be managed if you have, you know, clinicians who are skilled, they can prevent it from getting any worse. In some cases, often because in areas where you have lack of resources, you can progress to more severe disease like shock or death. But that's a very small proportion of
and
the cases.
And that's perhaps if you get dehydrated and what have you. So if there isn't adequate hydration and people aren't controlling the fever.
Or too much hydration. So if you have improper, you know, clinical management, right?
So where is it most prevalent, you said, in the tropics?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so dengue is what we consider to be endemic, where you have year-round transmission or, you know, regular transmission in the tropics and all the way through the subtropics. And it's, we found it moving into areas where it hasn't been reported in a long time, you know, in southern U.S., in
like
the Texas.
What states?
So since, I think, 2009, we've had dengue in Florida. We have some transmission always in the border region, so in the Texas-Arizona border region. I know there have been sporadic dengue outbreaks also in Hawaii.
In Florida as well?
Definitely in Florida and, you know, in Puerto Rico and many U.S. territories we have dengue.
And do they know how it got there? Was it again? And that's the question. So in other words, if someone experiences dengue and they come to this country, it can't be a human-to-human transmission. Mm-hmm. So how then is it spread?
So you have to have the mosquito vector. So in places like in Florida, we have the Aedes aegypti mosquito vector.
It lives there naturally. It's a natural habitat.
Exactly. And we find Aedes aegypti even in, you know, up going up the East Coast into, you know, New Jersey, I think. And so there's potential for transmission, and there's even documented dengue transmission in Philadelphia from the 1700s. So it once, you know, back in the day, we used to have it. The same as we used to have malaria in this area. In central New York, we used to have malaria.
It's hard to believe, isn't it?
Right. But a lot of the reason we don't is because you have changing social conditions. People have air conditioning. You have screens on doors and windows. You know, we have a very effective public health system here.
But we also have other tick-borne and other mosquito-borne diseases even in this area now. Mm-hmm. And there's some concern about West Nile and what else.
And Tripoli.
And
tick-borne diseases like Lyme disease. Yeah.
Exactly. So it does continue. Mm-hmm. So the bottom line is if somebody is infected with dengue and they're resolving and an Aegypti mosquito bites them, do they then pick up sufficient amount of the vector or the virus to then infect another person?
Potentially. So it depends when the mosquito bites you, right? So during the first few days of illness, that's when the virus is replicating and circulating in your bloodstream. That's when you would be considered to be infectious. And if a mosquito, you know, Aedes aegypti or Aedes albopictus mosquito bites you during that window, then they could pick up enough of the virus to pass it to someone else, probably someone else in your family, because these mosquitoes live in and around the home, right? But if you're later in the process, so say you went on vacation to Puerto Rico and then you had fever and then you came back to the U.S., you're at the tail end of the illness, you're probably not so infectious, you know, so you have lower chance of being able to pass the disease to someone else.
But the fact is it is existing and is it continuing to exist in in the environment of the continental United States?
Yes.
So somehow it's being...
It's persisting
it's
in
persisting.
Florida especially, yeah.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's Health Link on Air. I'm here with Dr. Anna Stewart Ibarra, and we're talking about, she's a global health researcher, and we're talking about dengue fever, but we're also talking about what is prompting it to kind of spread to some of these areas. And you've been engaged in a fair amount of research now for several years, trying to look at what the factors are that are contributing to the spread or the prevalence of this disease, dengue, and some other diseases as well. Tell us about your research.
Yeah, so as we mentioned, dengue is now a problem in the U.S., but predominantly we see sort of worldwide, we see most dengue in more tropical areas, like in Latin America and Asia. And so I've been working in Ecuador, which is right located on the equator, so in South America, between Peru and Colombia on the Pacific coast. It's a small country, but it's a country where we see lots of dengue transmission. And so we've been working in partnership with the local Ministry of Health and other universities to understand what are the triggers, what are the climate factors, and also what are the local social risk factors that influence the disease, and how can we develop more effective interventions so that we can improve the health of the population.
Especially until or if a vaccine is developed, because
exactly.
at this point you're really facing mm-hmm. what are the larger factors that may either make it more fertile ground mm-hmm. for this disease to spread, or the contrary to things that could actually quell the spread.
Yeah, so I mean,
so what are the household factors that you came up with, or what, in other words, what are people mm-hmm. doing in their own lives that either promote or dissuade the disease from spreading?
So one of the important risk factors is household water storage. So people, and we do this here in central New York too, rain barrels, right? And so how people store water in and around the home.
Standing water.
Exactly.
Pools of standing water are a problem.
Mm-hmm. Because specifically this mosquito breeds in and around the household in urban areas. And so we provide, you know, the perfect habitat for the mosquitoes to reproduce, and then we are the food, right? So they have mm-hmm. their food and their habitat all in one. They're incredibly well adapted to urban environments.
But how is the change in environment? So what you're saying, people obviously what would follow from that is to attempt to utilize, you know, different methods of storing things, closed covers or mm-hmm. what have you, but also maybe use of mosquito nets. I would think all of these kinds of things
screens
could help.
On windows and screens, doors, screens on air windows. Conditioning if you can afford it.
But in the larger context mm-hmm. of the climate environment, mm-hmm. what factors have you found are either prompting or promoting the, mm-hmm. the spread of these, or the even the emergence of new problems?
Yeah. So one of the things we find is that warmer air temperatures and more rainfall has increased the risk of a disease in these areas. And that's linked to these extreme climate events, like the El Nino events, which is something that we're seeing this coming year. There's forecasts coming out from NOAA, from the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Service of the U.S., projecting high probability of an El Nino event this year. And El Nino events are these global, what we call coupled ocean climate phenomenon. So we see this warming of the oceans, and that triggers climate events, extreme climate events across the world, which could be flooding or droughts. So specifically where we work in Ecuador, when we see El Nino events, we see an increase in the temperature. So everything becomes warmer and wetter. It starts raining more. And historically, we have had major disease outbreaks during El Nino events. So,
how frequently does El Nino events, or does El Nino occur?
Mm-hmm. So El Nino events recur every few years, maybe 5 to 7 years. But what's more important for us is how often do very strong El Nino events occur, because there can be weaker or stronger events, right? So the last time we had a very strong El Nino event was 1998, and prior to that was in the early 1980s. And when we have very strong El Nino events, that's when we need to pay more attention, because that can be linked to flooding and also, like I said, warmer temperatures. So we have risk of mosquito-borne diseases like dengue and malaria, but also we have increased risk of waterborne diseases like leptospirosis or cholera, which are transmitted during flooding events.
So what can be done? I mean, and I guess the other question I have is mm-hmm. if El Nino is really, El Nino is not a function of climate change at this point, is it? Or is it?
Well, El Nino is this, like I said, global sort of ocean climate event. But with climate change, there are forecasts that say that we will have more frequent and stronger El Nino events. And so we're that's likely to come sort of in the next year, let's say, 20 to 50 years here. It's very complicated, you know, still this understanding of how the climate systems work, but that's been some of the most recent work in this area of climate modeling shows that we expect more frequent and stronger El Nino, these extreme climate events.
And there's a close correlation then between, as you said, the warming mm-hmm. and the increased moisture mm-hmm. and increases in the kinds of diseases that you've described, the waterborne or the insect-borne diseases.
Yes, that's correct.
So the question, I guess, would be, well, first of all, where is your research headed? What are you proposing as a result of your findings? Mm-hmm. And is there anything that can be done? I mean, short of obviously a global mm-hmm. effort to change the fact that we're having mm-hmm. global warming.
Yeah, so we need a multi-pronged approach, right? And part of our work has been pulling together this group of diverse actors, you know, people from universities, people from the climate sector, from the meteorological sector, from that public health sector, to start talking and working together to develop these solutions. You know, we're working also closely now with the Secretary of Risk because they manage things like disasters and flooding. And so we're creating a space for a dialogue that didn't exist before to come up with new solutions. Specifically from our research, I think one of the focuses has been how to develop early warning systems to be able to create predictions of when these epidemics will occur and to be able to provide that information to decision makers so that they can decide how, you know, they want to allocate resources, if they need to hire more people or purchase more, you know, insecticide or do more public health campaigns in a given year. We're also working closely with Syracuse University and with partners in Ecuador and the Department of Defense to develop new mosquito control techniques. And so developing new technologies, new ways to...
Give me an example of what one might be.
So we're developing a device that you would place in the household, a low-cost device that would attract the mosquito and kill the mosquito. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that we're testing currently in Ecuador, but something that could potentially be used anywhere in the world.
Worldwide, right, with any of the issues.
Exactly.
With mosquitoes, right?
And then, as you mentioned before, of course, the vaccine is a really important research effort that's ongoing. And our group at Upstate with the Center for Global Health is very actively involved in research to develop a dengue vaccine. Although a dengue vaccine is likely going to be on the market very soon. There are many different candidates for dengue vaccines, many different companies working worldwide. But I think an important message is that I don't think we will ever be relying on just the vaccine. We need an integrated approach. So we need to be able to look at new ways to control mosquitoes. We need to have the vaccine, and we need to have better information about when and where and how we have likely outbreaks. So we need this sort of holistic approach.
So you have a new project. A little bit of time we have left. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is an exciting new project that was funded by the National Science Foundation and the National Institute of Health. It's a joint program called the Ecology and Evolution of Emerging Infectious Diseases. And it's a $2.5 million project, 5 years. The main project is coming through Stanford, and we are one of the partners on the grant. And so that will involve 3 years of field studies going on in Ecuador to understand how climate is affecting dengue at different climate, sort of in different elevations, looking at elevational gradients. So we're working at higher elevations where we don't typically see the disease. We're working in an area where we have disease year-round and a very dry, almost desert-like condition. And we're working with a team of modelers, mathematical modelers and entomologists from University of Florida, from Penn State, from Stanford and others, to be able to develop better predictions and better mathematical models and to explain and understand how and when these disease outbreaks happen.
So again, the whole methodology here that you're going to employ is the attempt is to be predictive, because as you said, you know, we're not changing global warming overnight. So the idea is that if you can be predictive and reliably predictive, perhaps you can take certain measures to prevent the spread.
Exactly.
All these variety of measures. And hopefully with the work that's being done with regard to a vaccine, that will be one more arm in your armamentarium to try to fight the disease and other global diseases that are emerging as a result of all this.
Yeah, I think all of these strategies, we could consider different sorts of climate change adaptation strategies. You know, how can we better deal with the changing climate? It's already happening. You know, climate affects health today. This is known. This is not up for debate, you know. How it will affect health in 100 years, there's a lot of room to discuss there. But climate affects health now. You know, millions of people are affected every year by heat waves and flooding, and it's something we need to deal with and address today.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing all this great information with us. My guest has been Dr. Anna Stewart Ibarra. She's from the Center for Global Health and Translational Science at Upstate Medical University. This is Upstate's HealthLink on air. Linda Cohen along with you. Sleep disorders are at epidemic proportions worldwide and affect both the health and quality of life for all who suffer from them. And what's worse is that they occur both in adults and children. But the good news is they can be prevented and treated. So here to explain this is Dr. Safir Sultan, Associate Professor of Pediatrics, specializing in pediatric pulmonary medicine, and the Director of the Division of Pediatric Pulmonary and Sleep Medicine at Upstate's Golisano Children's Hospital. Welcome, Dr. Sultan.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for coming in. So how common are sleep problems in children? How common are they?
Well, I can say they are common across the board with different problems across a different age group. We can say 10% of children can have sleep-related issue of different types depending on the age. Also, it's very common to have, let's call it a problem, but not disorder, and that's much, much more common than just disorder. What I mentioned is a disorder of a rate of 10%, but bad habits and abnormal behavior during sleep are very common, maybe up to 50% and maybe more can have these, but those are not disorders.
So I'm glad that you made that distinction because quite often I think about some of these kinds of sleep problems in that general category as somewhat developmental or having more to do with maybe some environmental things going on in the life of the child as opposed to something intrinsic, like something wrong in the way their body functions.
Yeah. Like mentioning developmental, for example, as you stated, developmental, the circadian rhythm in adolescent, a normal development is that toward teenage years, your typical adolescent circadian rhythm shift to a later time. They start sleeping at a later time. And
which
that
means they like to stay up later and they sleep later?
Yes, comparing to primary school children who sleep early. This, unless it's kind of, unless we put some limit on it and unless perhaps eventually we change the school system so to allow these adolescents to wake up at later time, this simple developmental problem, as you put it, Linda, will end up to a disorder where the adolescents sleep very late and they have to wake up very early to go to school. Then we end up with a sleepy teenager.
Yeah.
So it starts as a developmental issue. It's just a natural development of adolescent to sleep at a later time, and it may end up into a severe problem. And there where they come to us as a disorder. We call it circadian rhythm disorder. So as I stated, there are disorders where things go out of hand and adolescents sleep at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and they can't make it school, to a simple issue where we just want them to sleep at an earlier time. And that simple issue, I think 50% or more of adolescents suffer of that.
Adolescents clearly stand out in that regard for all the reasons you stated. And also probably there are some cultural things about, you know, our culture often says you should get off on less sleep. Somehow there's the idea of being almost machismo. If you sleep too much, you're a wimp kind of thing. So there's that too. But let's get to younger children. When we talk about infants, first of all, are there truly sleep disorders that take place in infancy? Or is it mostly, again, trying to establish the circadian rhythm that children need?
So in infants, there are not true sleep disorders unless it is related to congenital anomalies. Infants have congenital anomaly which make them unable to breathe well while asleep, then they have disorder of breathing-related issue. But during infancy, usually is basically the circadian rhythm of infant is taking shape, and infant who sleep usually many hours during the day and they do not have day and night schedule are supposed to be encouraged by their parents to develop this type of schedule. If this doesn't happen for different reason, then a problem will start, and that usually by first year of life, by 1 year, 2 year of age, where we see the first problem. So if you don't mind, I can list the first problem. That is an infant who, or toddler now, 1 year or 1 year and a half of age, who he or she has never learned how to sleep on their own. The learning process, how to soothe themselves to sleep, wasn't done. And as a result, these infants cannot fall asleep unless the parents are present. So these infants fall asleep in the presence of parents, yet anything wake them up in the middle of the night will make them feel anxious and afraid, and they would start screaming and crying for the parents to soothe them back to sleep because they never learned the process. So here we go. This is the first problem we see. That's parent bringing toddlers to us, 1 year, 1.5 year of age, saying that these toddlers don't sleep. They keep waking up crying. And the reason they do that is because the process wasn't done, either because of parents' issue and or infant issue. It's not always parents' faults. There are many inherent problems in certain infants which make them take a little longer to learn this process.
So that that actually then becomes a problem.
Yes.
But is it truly a disorder? And I wanted to, what I'd like to have you help us with is, what are the real, also, what are the additional disorders that show up? For example, does sleep apnea exist in children? And that is truly something to do with the way the body functions.
Yeah. So disorder is when it has consequences, when the issue affects the child or the parent's life. So this problem I mentioned of what we call behavioral insomnia, it is very much disorder to the parents more than the children.
Yes.
Children wake up, cry, and then they get the parent to carry them and take them to the parents' room. However, parents lose jobs and lose sleep, and that affect them. Yes, sleep apnea exists in children and start from infants, and it moves on toward late adolescent, toward adulthood. The reason for sleep apnea in children is different than that in adults. In children, in infants, it starts where it's usually caused by congenital anomalies in kids, and then it moves on to large tonsils and adenoid in early childhood. And then we start to have obesity problems toward late childhood and adolescence.
So the rate
is 3 to 5% of children across the age groups can have obstructive sleep apnea.
So that is as a result of some obstruction in their breathing capability.
Much
like occurs with adults.
So in adult, the most common cause is usually obesity. In children, the most common cause is usually large tonsils and adenoids. And obesity now, as you know, is increasing and rising, and it's becoming also a contributor to obstructive sleep apnea in kids. Yes, this problem is when kids don't breathe well while asleep, and that will disturb the sleep cycle and will make them sleep deprived.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with sleep expert Dr. Safir Sultan. We're talking about sleep problems in children. So very briefly, are there other sleep disorders that occur in children that we should know about at any age?
Yeah, so we talked that we have insomnia, and we said insomnia start in early childhood. And most of the time, insomnia in children is behavioral, and I have summarized how this problem issue and... And then we talked about obstructive sleep apnea. And then we have we also talked about the circadian rhythm problem when kids, usually adolescents, tend to sleep very late, and that will make them sleep deprived because they would like to sleep late and wake up, and they have to wake up to school, but they can't do it now. We also, same as adult, we have restless leg syndrome, which certain category of kids feel the urge, a sensation to move their legs, and that usually bothers them and make them unable to fall asleep, and that will lead to insomnia. And we do have also narcolepsy and excessive sleepiness, which usually start in adolescence. However, there are reports, although rare, about narcolepsy starting in early childhood. So in our the category of the disorders of sleep in children are exactly almost the same in adult. Adult, they do have a couple of entities we do not have. They tend to start at adult age.
So what are the consequences? I mean, obviously, you've got the developing brain. You've got the need for sleep for all kinds of reasons, to repair the body, to as a way of resetting, and, you know, basically rejuvenating each person every time they sleep. Yeah. What are the consequences when you have poor sleep in a child?
So, as you said, we need to reset the functions of the brain, and we need to help the brain develop and grow, especially in young kids. So sleep deprivation has been shown to affect the strongest effect is usually on kids' behavior. Behavior is the main
indicator
of a problem with sleep. Younger age group, they develop behavioral disorder by being hyperactive, aggressive. Older age group, they develop risk-taking behaviors and aggressiveness and emotional disorders. Second to behavioral problem and emotional problem, we do have a cognitive problem. It has been also documented that sleep deprivation will affect the cognitive function of younger and older children. Adolescents were tested on a computer simulator to drive or to take decisions, and they were slower in judgment comparing to other kids, and they took risk kids who sleep well do not take. Grades of younger age group who don't sleep well are lower than grades of kids who sleep better. In certain younger age group, sleep deprivation and breathing disorders can affect the weight gain. They don't grow well.
Yeah, is there a relation or a correlation between sleep disorder and obesity? In other words, I know the other way. If a child is already obese, they may develop sleep apnea, much like in an adult. But how about if a child just has a sleep disorder, does it lead to something like obesity?
Yes. So sleep deprivation has been shown to cause obesity by increasing appetite, and especially for carbohydrate. And also in theory that we have a theory, actually we have improved it, that sleep deprived children, they are less active during the daytime, and perhaps that's why they are overweight. So it's kind of like it's hard to know which causing what.
Is it the chicken or the egg?
Yeah. On the same question, younger age group, when they do struggle to breathe while asleep, they do lose weight. They don't gain weight because they work hard to breathe during sleep. So to answer your question, it can cause failure to gain weight or obesity.
Either one, extreme.
Yeah.
So I understand that you've had a sleep center at Upstate Scalasano Children's Hospital for a number of years, 3 or 4 years now, and more recently you set up a pediatric sleep lab.
Yeah.
What does the lab do? How does it help you diagnose the problems, and what comes of those diagnoses? I don't want to run out of time. So.
I'm glad, Linda, that you asked that to tell the audience that and the public that we've been maturing, we've been developing. Right now we have our new and we are proud of state-of-art sleep lab, which is a standalone lab. It's a state-of-art facility opened a year ago, and it's basically it has 4 dedicated beds for pediatrics. So this is a new development. In the past, we were part of the sleep lab at Community General Hospital. Now we have standalone lab, which still has adult services. However, we have our own technicians specialized in pediatrics. They are gentle, well-trained. They deal well with pediatrics. We are getting very nice review from the patients and the parents. The sleep lab is essential for our function. It helps us make diagnosis of quite a few of the disorders I mentioned. And sometimes also it helps us treating these disorders. For example, there are certain sleep disorders, such as obstructive sleep apnea, which cannot be treated surgically. Then we need to apply assisted ventilation, which is known to the public. It's called CPAP therapy, and that cannot be applied. But in the sleep lab, where we test how much pressure we need to apply in a small mask on the face to help the child who has sleep apnea sleep better and resolve the issue of sleep apnea. So the sleep lab is essential for diagnosis and treatment.
Wonderful. Well, I wish you a great deal of good fortune with this, and it's obviously a great service to this community to have something of that nature here. Thank you so much for coming in and telling us all about this. My guest is Dr. Safir Sultan, Associate Professor of Pediatrics, specializing in pediatric pulmonary medicine, and he's also the Director of the Division of Pediatric Respiratory and Sleep Medicine at Upstate's Golisano Children's Hospital.
Thank you very much.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
V.P. Loggins is a wonderful poet and author of two books, The Fourth Paradise and Heaven Changes. He tackles a health problem very common in older men, yet not one we hear discussed too often, except on television commercials. Here is his witty but poignant poem, Low T. A graphic novelty, a character you hear about daily. Sensuous grasses sway in the breeze, and you think of it. The crow calls from the sycamore, and you feel it. When Dickinson's fly buzzes, you hear the song of death, and you know it lies near you, undeniably present in the song, and as brittle as a dry branch. If you remember what time you first heard its insistent chant, you will probably remember asking yourself what the words meant. If it sounds like cicadas or the grating of iron filings, you will note it later. Hamlet famously put the age-old point to Claudius and his mother. High tea is an afternoon delight made more delightful by sweet cakes and sunshine. But this is not your age, you're told. It's a number. What a number it has done on you, you think. You could, of course, take a pill, rub some compound in the appropriate places, hidden completely from view. But then you might wonder, what is it to grow old, really? Would it be or not be like the light in the bulb burning out or the bulb breaking? Would its truth be like the play in which a youth wrote sonnets and tacked them to the trees only to hang them there no more? You know that sycamore is a pun for love gone bad. But you do not want to admit how love that's right has its failings too. So when she turns in the darkness toward you, you will try, if not for your sad sake, then hers. Have some character, you think. Orpheus went to hell and back for Eurydice, though he lost his head. What's your problem?
Thank you for joining us for HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we get the latest update on this year's flu season. Plus, if you're having restless nights, what can you do to help get the rest you need? And we'll get the latest advice about treating prostate cancer. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it. That's on iTunes. Just search for HealthLink on Air. That's all one word. And to keep up with all the goings on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks so much for listening.